The JTAP Podcast, Episode 66. Send it.
I can do that. JTAX. Clearing it hot, making it rain, and bringing the boom boom.
Welcome, everybody, to Episode 66 of the JTAP Podcast. I would say reaching across the pond, but obviously that doesn't even make any sense anymore when I say it. But reaching into our Anglico brothers here. Teddy, I appreciate you taking the time and sitting down and talking with me, man.
No problem. I love it. I mean, anytime guys can get together and talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, I like to start all these things by saying, you know, that everyone's opinion on here is their own and it's not that of any organization. And, you know, that's our sort of legal get out of jail free card within reason, I guess.
That's good, because I'm going to probably say some things that'll piss some people off.
Yeah. Well, it's just your opinion, right?
Yeah.
So, Teddy, obviously, we've been shooting the shit back and forth and stuff, but like, to put things into context, where do you come from? Where did you grow up? Sort of what was the family structure? And kind of what was like schooling and stuff like for you?
Wow. So that's a 4-hour podcast in itself. But if I give you the 30-second elevator pitch, I grew up in orphanages and foster care system, lived with my parents for a little bit, drugs, abuse, all that kind of stuff. And this was in New York. I lived in New York. And then my brother and I were 10 months apart. We kind of met some other family members, biological, did a little hookup, drive down, a little bit of hitchhiking as teenagers, and made it down to South Florida to find our dad, who we never knew. And met him. Didn't really work out so well. So then I'm off on my own trying to pay my way through high school. And was kind of set up for football, to go to college for football. Did a couple of things that weren't accepted by the scholarship office after being awarded the scholarship for football. And I got let go before I even got in. And so then I was like kind of on the street a little bit. And a Marine Corps recruiter drove by, saw me on a bus stop one day. And I don't know what I was doing, going to do something stupid probably. He's like, I remember you from high school. Didn't you want to join? I was like, yeah, but it never worked out. He's like, how about now? I said, if I leave in a week for the Marine Corps, I'll go. So there it was. He's like, yeah. So I stayed at his house and a couple other people's houses a couple nights. And probably 10 days later, I was gone.
Wow.
Off to Marine Corps boot camp. There I was.
Well, that was a race through what you're right is like, I think I just have like 1,000 questions about just that part of your life, man. That's insane.
If I meet people and we talk about the my life before the military, they're usually like, you should write a book. And I'm like, oh, well, now I joined the military and it gets worse or better, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah. I mean, that is a good opening chapter to a book. If it might be the thickest chapter going, but yeah, it's pretty insane. So like, that's amazing that like, so how did you stay in the same town? How did this guy recognize you?
The recruiters, they're kind of regional, right? So I was in the same county. I lived in a not so nice part of town after, you know, I was living with my old man that we found. It didn't work out. Just typical teenager, you know, thinking you're the baddest kid on the earth problems. Didn't work out. So I'm paying this Jamaican dude $300 a month to sleep on his couch.
Okay.
And I'm taking the public transport bus, the city bus, we called it, you know, 45 minutes to get back and forth to school. I was kind of proud of myself. I'm like, well, I'm a grown ass man still in school, paying my way through school. And it felt good. And I was still able to do the football team, all this stuff. So still able to mess around with the girls, which was always important. And then, there was a couple decision points and with the scholarship and all that stuff. And then I went out for an exhibition and there was a couple of screenings and tests and it just didn't go well for me because of just kind of who I was. I thought I was this little gangster kid, if you will. I was like an anti-government community guy, like, nah, screw the man. The man's always trying to screw you. That's, you know, the little sayings. I didn't even know we were at war. You know, this was 2002. And I didn't even know I knew Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden and all these things were problems, but I was never really focused on it. So I was like, okay, whatever, not my problem. They better not come here or I'll kick somebody's ass kind of attitude.
Is there the thing you said, like, that he knew that you'd wanted to join before.
Yeah, so he was, you know, I was a captain of the football team, and so the recruiters always go after the athletes.
Okay.
Especially the Marine recruiters. And then, you know, they, you know, you're a teenager, and they take you to a titty bar for lunch. After they pick you up from high school, and you get permission to leave, and they're taking you to titty bars, and they're just selling you down the road on all the rock star life, and Marines wear the sexy uniforms, and, you know, after two beers, we knock out, you know, 30 pull-ups in the recruiting office and talk shit all afternoon, and, you know, it's like, that's like, for a high school kid, that's like micro-celebrity behavior. So you're like, yeah, this is exactly what I want, especially for me, a guy who grew up with nothing on the streets to begin with.
Yeah.
So I was like, whatever, I can do this. This is fun.
So when he eventually did get his claws into you, what did he sell you? Like, what did you sign as?
So I already graduated high school for a couple of weeks, and I was going through a real bad spot because the Jamaican dude I was renting his living room from, I was like, hey, brother, I was thinking about this, and he was like, he was super anti-government, and he essentially tossed me out of his house. He's like, I don't want your money no more. Get the fuck out of here. So then I was kind of like sleeping at friend's house here and there. You know, for lack of a better word, I was homeless. And then I spent, you know, the better part of 70% of my time sleeping at freaking bus stops, you know, and trying to get some jobs and money here and there. And he saw me in a bus stop one day. I don't know if I was on my way to a job interview or on my way to go hang out with a girlfriend, but he was like, he remembered me. We were talking. He literally just pulled his car up and stopped in the middle of the road, and I'm sitting on this bus stop, and I said, do I get to sleep on a bed? He goes, yes. I go, I'll leave right now. That's the only way I'm doing it, if I leave right now. He's like, the best I can do is 10 days. I'm like, fine. Give me a bed in 10 days and you got a deal. That was my stipulation, was I was tired of sleeping outside.
Yeah.
So, makes sense. So that was my incentive. I never knew it would take me where it got me. But, you know, I always say, without the Marine Corps, I would have been nothing.
Yeah. You know, a simple man with simple needs. Just need a bed. It's fine. I'm good with that.
Short rabbit hole to dive down real quick. This dude ends up getting arrested later in his life because of faking his identity.
What?
Yeah, man. Apparently he was like a career criminal before he joined the Marine Corps.
Amazing.
And so I was like, you know, that's probably why he recognized me, because we were these two street guys, and he was living this life that was fake for him. And I guess he went on a deployment later on in his career, and he scanned his passport in Ireland, and it alerted Interpol, facial recognition software. And I'm not lying. People told me the story. They were there, dudes I know. And they're like, FBI stopped the plane when it landed in Baltimore. And they got FBI walked on the plane with the TAC guys outside, but they just walked on thinking it was going to be, you know, cool. And it was. They called his name. He stood up. They said, get off the plane. They got him off the plane. Then they let the plane finish taxiing.
That's insane. I love it.
Nobody's heard from him since.
Oh my God. You know what? The people you bump into in your fucking life is crazy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I was pissed at that guy because I'd won all these football awards and scholarships and all these other awards and things. And I went to all these dinners, and, you know, that was the only thing I had in my life that I achieved on my own. And this dude got rid of all of it. So I was pissed at him.
Yeah.
Because when I went off to boot camp, I had nowhere to live. So I went off to boot camp. He's like, I'll hold all your stuff, all your scholarship plaques and awards and all this stuff. And I was like, yeah. Couple little pictures of family and stuff growing up, all of it's gone. So I was completely non-existent in any physical, tangible memory.
Yeah. You started on day one of boot camp, and everything before that
was gone.
You were made at that point.
Yeah. So
you were never born.
Pretty much. I've been, thanks to social media, I've been able to connect with people and get some other pictures, but that's about it.
So joining the Marine Corps and going through boot camp, when you come out the other end, are you a rifleman? What MOS did you end up going to?
So I ended up going to field radio operator.
Okay.
0621. I think they changed it to systems operator now, or transmission operator, whatever it was. And that's what birthed me into Anglico from the jump. Cause Anglico's got, you know, two enlisted. I was an enlisted guy, right? So two MOSs, well, two operating MOSs. You got your radio operators and your forward observers. And so I went the radio operator out, and, you know, that MOS was great for me because I was already kind of a closet nerd. So in my brain, I was good with numbers. I mean, I lived this like wannabe gangster lifestyle in high school, but I graduated with damn near straight A's because I just had this, you know, eidetic memory and numbers made sense to me and I never failed a test. So it just, I don't know. It played to that nerd brain that I had still.
You said, so when you came out of that and you went through training, did you go to a Marine Corps company or did you go straight to Anglico as a sailor?
So straight to Anglico. When you're in radio operator school, we called it FROC. I don't know what they call it now. It's in 29 Palms, California, so not too far from where you're at. The recon guys come out and you can do, at the time, you can do the recon screening. And I passed that and they were trying to recruit me for recon, but they're like, oh, you got to go through BRC and all this sort of stuff. I still had a little bit of tough guy left in me. And I was like, no, fuck this. I was like, I've already been through boot camp and Marine combat training, which is like a half-assed junior varsity version of making every Marine an infantryman, but it is what it is. Teaches you to walk for long distances with a lot of heavy stuff in bad weather while getting yelled at and stressed out. So great, good training for young guys and girls. I was like, I don't need to be hazed or treated like a nobody. I was like, I already earned my spot. Fuck that. I'm not doing that. So even though I passed their little assessment, I don't even want to call it selection, their assessment or whatever it was called, I was like, no, I don't want this. And then I think I was number two or number three in the class. And so, you know, everybody gets their pick at that point.
Yeah.
Some dudes were, you know, in retrospect, I would have loved to have picked Japan.
Okay.
Because I didn't make it to Japan until later in my career. But then again, I think of myself and I'm like, you know, when I was that young, I probably got in trouble. So I like the way things worked out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, we're sat here now. So probably it was the way it was meant to be.
It was. I've broken a lot of glass ceilings, a lot of first offs for guys in my field. You know, I mean, just outright saying it, you know, I've never met another, communicator radio. I became a radio chief later on who was a JTAC instructor and a JTAC evaluator, let alone and then all, you know, all the jump master spies, fries, hearse master, all those other quals, like guys were like, why don't you do this, why don't you do that, you can go do this, you can do that. I'm like, you know, every time somebody says that, right around the corner is another blessing if I just maintain the path I'm on.
Yeah.
And so I've never really questioned my intuition and what my mentors directly have provided me. So, you know, it always worked out. But I've never been a guy to play the sympathy card either. Usually I put my foot in my mouth more often, but you know, I always proved worth it in the end.
Yeah. And I think that's a good thing for people to take away is like, you know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth or whatever, you know, whatever the saying needs to be, but it's like, you know, when you're offered an opportunity, the easiest part of it is saying yes. You know what I mean? And you see people, too often are like, oh, maybe, no, not this time, whatever, you know, put it, I'll kick it on down the road. But you turn around and say yes, obviously you're gonna have to put yourself through a lot of pain afterwards to be successful, but yeah. you say yes, you're probably setting yourself on a path to an incredible life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've weathered a lot of storms maintaining the path that I've wanted to and try not to take some of these handouts or adjustments. And some of them aren't handouts, some of them are challenges. I've turned down some long walk opportunities. I've turned down some different skill opportunities, but I did it for my own, you know, adjustment of priorities. And that was the other thing is like, you know, we can get into too, I don't want to fast forward you know, 17 years of my career, but there was a point where I was like, okay, what am I doing this for? What's the why, you know? Yep. And when I started adjusting what the why was, I became more interested in setting the next generation up of Marine, soldier, airman, Navy and or sailor, I guess we'll call them. And once I started seeing the reward in training the younger guys, I became less interested in getting along with my peers and following the beaten path that was trailblazed for instructors and evaluators. I was like, no, I don't care about that. Let's get down in the weeds. This is what the end state is. This is what our next generation should look like, what they should focus on. So let's train them how not to make the same mistakes that we made. Let's train them how to be better walking into these situations. Then when I started seeing that, you know, I don't want to dive too deep into the personal side unless you want to, but I started seeing like, okay, well, I'm seeing the same thing with my family. Like, okay, well, I was ignoring family life because again, growing up the way I grew up, I was never taught, hey, this is how you take care of a family either. You know, I've slept like, just, I mean, we talked earlier, you know, my personal life did not prepare me for that. But then once I saw how I was doing it in the military, you know, I was having all my young guys call me back after they went on deployments, after I trained them on a deployment with me. And they're calling me saying, hey, dude, I was in a gunfight and all I could hear in the, when I was hiding behind a wall was your words. And it gave me the courage to stand up, take command of the situation, and give my best back to the enemy. And it worked out to everyone's favor. So when I hear phone calls like that and get emails like that, to me, that was more rewarding. And I started applying that same methodology to my family. And I was able to repair damages that I'd caused for years to my family. So, yeah. You know, again, it was one of those things where if I would have took another route, if I would have taken the long walk to this place, or that people were shining, waving that card in front of me, here's a free entry pass if you make it. And I was like, you know what? It's not worth it.
No.
It's not worth it because it would have caused damage in other arenas of my life that I was already trying to make up for.
Yeah, absolutely. So like, let's go back and sort of build a picture of where that's come from. So you arrive into your first unit, obviously young signaler going in there. What unit do you go to, and what does it look like showing up there? You know, obviously qualified to do your job, but not really ready.
So there was an Anglico detachment. I want to say it was like one platoon, which it was less than a real platoon doctrinally, because I'm so nerded out on the doctrine, but it was a little less than a full platoon strength. So I was probably like 35 guys, and they were deploying to Iraq, and I wanted nothing more to be on that deployment. I was talking to the company leadership, every senior staff NCO, and here's the thing: I was not a typical private first class. I was not afraid to talk to people because their collar weighed a couple more ounces than someone else's. And so I was like, hey, you know, is there a married guy who you want him to stay home and kiss his wife? You know, this was late 2003. I want to say like September of 2003. I'm like, you know, so it was early in the Iraq war and there was still that impending fear, impending doom that you would never come home. And so I was like, hey, kick a family guy off and let me go. And they were like, no, you're too eager. We're going to find you a spot, but you just got here. Like, all you know is school and how to salute. It's like, let's get your feet wet a little bit. The best thing they could do for me is they're like, look, you want to do training? I said, I want to do training right now. They put me through some licensing course for the new Marine Corps 7-ton vehicle, which it was never needed, but they were like, how do we make this energetic kid go away? And then my buddy who checked in with me, we checked in together. We both graduated at the same time. We didn't know each other, but we ended up realizing through stories that we followed each other from boot camp all the way throughout, and we're checking in at the same time. And they sent him to airborne school right away. Again, I still had that little like tough guy. I don't want to do this for real. I just want to like, you know, I just want to be a Spartan with a sword at that point, because I started to understand a little bit of that. I didn't want to be anything special, and I just wanted to go. And in my mind, I was like, I'm going to go and be a hero and not come home is what's going to happen. Like every, you know, Spartan would believe. That was a young teenager. And I came back from the course. I learned how to drive this really big ass truck, which worked out to my benefit many, many times for unconventional reasons throughout my career. But those are not appropriate stories. there's probably a couple of appropriate ones we can get into, but I'm trying to think. So the timeline's a little hazy because, you know, it's almost 20 years ago. So I came back from the course. I'm like, all right, can I go now? They're like, no, these guys they're in their final 3 weeks. They're going through one more academics package. They only had like, I think 6 weeks, because there was no such thing as a pre-deployment training at this time, because, you know, the Marine Corps was still trying to figure that out. They just knew that these guys had to go get their family and legal stuff squared away. I think they had 6 weeks from the time they were notified to the time they left. They're like, you can go, you can teach all their comm classes. So I was like, cool, I'll teach all their comm classes. So I show up to the commo shop now. I've already been in the unit for a month, haven't even met my boss. Show up to the commo shop, and it's this old force recon gunnery sergeant, and he hands me this SATCOM radio, the PSC-5, if you remember, big black one. And he's like, here, you need to teach class on this. I'm like, they didn't teach us this in school. He's like, not my fucking problem. You signed up to teach the class, didn't you? I go, yeah. He's like, well, here's the manual. So I spent the next, I didn't sleep, but maybe 2 hours or the rest of that night, just reading that manual, programming shit, testing. I was like, not going to fail. I refuse to fail. That was one ethos I've had in my life is refuse to fail. And I showed up the next day. I taught the class, knocked it out of the fucking park. And the gunny pulled me aside afterwards. He's like, how'd you do that? And I'm like, you told me, good luck. I was like, okay. So I was like, all the power was mine. So it was mine to win or lose. And he's like, well, you fucking won. And at this point, he started like mentoring me to some of his old ways. He was trained by Vietnam dudes and a lot of that showed. And he was training me. He's like, look, you know, fuck tact, fuck courtesies. If you're right, you can tell anyone to fuck off as long as your facts are right. And so I kind of live by that still to this day. As long as you're fucking right, the delivery, yeah, delivery is important when you're doing sales, but wasn't in the business of sales. So fuck the delivery. You know, cleared hot sounds the same way no matter what fucking language or acronym accent you're using, right? So I live by those ethos. I got a lot of trouble, unofficial trouble. I dug a lot of fighting holes in the woods, did a lot of push-ups, getting eaten alive by mosquitoes for violating some courtesies, but I was never wrong. So that was a good feeling. I knew every frequency there was to know, every crypto thing you could think of, and then I even knew beyond that, right? I became a jump master by the time I was in E4, which no one does anymore. It's few and far between, unless you work for the Pair Loft, right? The shoot packers. Became a hearse master very short thereafter, and so I was like, you can't tell me shit about parachuting. I already know it all. You can't tell me shit, you know, anything jumping. You can't tell me shit about drop zones. You can't tell me shit about landing zones. You can't tell me shit about rappelling, fast roping. And so evolved, and they sent me to JFO school with 24 hours notice. The CO was like, you're one of my smarter guys. I just had a kid fail out of his prerequisites. You already did them, right? And this is me as a sergeant talking to the CO, and I'm like, yeah, finish them, sir. He's like, cool. You're going to JFO tomorrow. Captain, get the orders done. They did it. I was on a flight the next day. Made it through JFO, made a bunch of great networking friends in the senior enlisted for the fires community. And those guys are still friends and mentors to me to this day. But what I did not realize is I was breaking a ceiling that a lot of guys, they let the peer pressure and the community kick them down. But I had that refusal to fail mindset. So I'm this radio operator getting ready to be a radio chief. I've already got 3 combat deployments done, and I'm a fires guy all of a sudden, and I was good at it. So yeah. 3 months later, because there was a bunch of training right after school, 3 months later, the CO's like, hey, you want to do it again? I'm like, what do you mean? I'm not going to go to the same school twice. There's no reason. He goes, no. I had the same problem just happen. A captain just fucking failed his prerequisites for JTAC course. I was like, sure, why not? I was like,
How hard can it be, right?
I mean, I will say this. This will probably piss a bunch of people off. To me, because I went to the 82nd Airborne Division's Jump Master course, and I went to it in Tampa Bay, Florida. It was a mobile training team during spring break. So the instructors let us out every day by 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock. So we weren't getting a full 8 hours of training by them, but we're still being held to actually even a higher standard than the normal course.
Yeah.
And so to me, Jump Master School, Static Line Jump Master, was much more difficult than JTAC. And I would say a lot of it is because of the instructor's lack of preparation for the exam. And the exam was to a more strict standard than the standard exam. And I'm a Marine in an Army course on a joint base, and a whole bunch of other factors contributed to it. And it's a memorization course more than a you know, cognition course. So I still feel to this day, getting through JTAC school, if you understand the process, you'll make it. You know,
yeah.
You can get an 80% on some of the memorization skills, but if you understand the process and you're hitting goes and your sims and your live controls, they're gonna help you through.
I think. So, yeah. I mean, I think I'm in a privileged position of seeing it from obviously different sides. But from my perspective, if you have been I'll talk about today, like obviously with our pre-selection courses that we have in existence today.
Yeah.
It's difficult to fail the course.
I have no sympathy for guys who fail.
Because we've spent the last few years building out the programs and having prerequisites for the programs and et cetera, like if you turn up, there's going to be failures. That's life. But I mean, I look back at my basic course and I'm not saying it's not like, knowledge through a fire hose, but if you've got that I don't quit attitude and you're willing to go back in the evenings and read a bit of this, that and the other, and you know, most of the instructors that I had wanted us to be successful. You know, they were pointing us in the right direction. They were saying, these are the fucking questions you're going to get asked. These are the things you're going to be expected to do. You know, they were like, they were basically road signing you to what you should be reading in the evenings.
Yeah. Or he starts stomping his foot when he says a test question.
And you're like, so if you're the guy who's failing on those things, like I get it. Like some people just ain't going to get it. Like, you know, if you're not getting it in the Sims and you're not getting on the range, you ain't getting it. But all the other stuff.
But then you don't belong.
Yeah, right? But that's fine. Yeah, I'm okay with that. That's what I'm saying. Is like, if you can't run the process, then that's a different fucking question. Probably the pre-course should have thinned you out. But the other stuff, the instructional staff on every school that I've been to or seen want JTAC in. This is staying, like, I'm going to stay in my lane. They want you to be successful. And so they basically signpost you this is how you be successful. So if you're not listening to them,
yeah,
what the fuck are you doing there?
Well, and you know, every JTAC course I've taught, a few I've taught at yours, I've taught taught Australia's. If you know the Australia guy, I'm surprised, unless I didn't see it. I don't want to say his name because I don't know what he's doing now.
The British guy who's down there.
No. Oh, I'm talking about the lieutenant colonel spent too much time down there. But no, we can talk offline because I don't want to say his name because I end up where I don't know where he is now. But I taught the Canadians. I helped the Canadians stand up the Jordanian course, which, dude, you want to piss people off? Let's talk about standing up the Jordanian JTAC course. I still have people calling me telling me I'm a fucking asshole for doing that. And I'm like, let's get something straight, guys. I'm an enlisted dude. I didn't just go off and decide, hey, this country should have a JTAC vote. Like, they're a fucking MOA signatory. Like, they didn't just decide because Teddy showed up, let's fucking make a JTAC program. I had to submit fucking reports to the United States Embassy on every fucking interaction I had with people. Like, this was a very well-monitored thing. But again, it was back to the fact, this is really, you know, when you come down to, you know, brass tacks about it, there was a lot of senior dudes who didn't get an opportunity to do something like that in the fires world, the professional fires world, the 0861s and guys of the like. And here I am as a radio chief, you know, out here alone and unafraid with one other dude on this assignment, brought some more guys in, and I'm a JTAC instructor evaluator. I happen to be, you know, conveniently geolocated to execute this. And it didn't take away from what I was doing for my actual mission. So they're like, why fucking not? Took advantage of the opportunity. It was a great networking thing for me. I've got fucking friends now in Canada and Australia and other dudes. And I learned some cool shit about what the embassy is looking for. So I got some other tradecraft exposure that I, you know, people talk about and no one knows. And so you get to see some of those things. And that was great. Great opportunity, professional development, professional exposure, learning how to interact on that scale now that I've been a senior dude, because I hadn't been to any of the forward embassies that we have at that point since probably 2005 was the last time I made some embassy visits. And I was such a young hard hitter in 05 that I didn't make sense of what we were doing at the embassy. This point I got. So, but yeah, I have no sympathy, going back to the point, I have no sympathy for guys who fail because it tells me it's validated that you don't belong doing this job. We've seen too many people fuck this job up, and it cost us more than what we were willing to accept as a risk, or a commander was willing to accept as a risk. So those people don't belong there. Some people still make it through somehow. That's okay. Got it. But my major point I was trying to make there is the school shouldn't be called a school anymore in the way a lot of these schools, they're almost not a school of learning. They're just a school of evaluation, because the community has decided to take on so much preparatory work that the schoolhouses know this, and they endorse it, and they codify it in documents that you have to do all these things before you show up, that by the time you get there, they should just be able to test you in all of those skills and you go home. And yeah, they'll cover the clickety-click PowerPoint screen, but there's not a lot of show, teach, execute, evaluate methodology going on. Like if you study effective learning methods, they are far removed from a lot of military schools to this day and age, because those learning methods would only apply to a student knowing nothing walking in. And so it's got positives and negatives. The positives are you got smarter dudes graduating. The negatives are is units, the actual operating units, the operating forces, they're dedicating time and resources that is not part of their normal readiness path to preparing guys.
That's super interesting. I've got like a pin in my head of like your commanding officer sending you to JTAC school. So I got that pin in my head, so don't worry about that. But it's super interesting you say that, because the UK has gone the other direction and has given clear guidance and direction to its units that they're to do the pre-course screening to load people. And then those people then go to the school, and then they do a two-day assessment process, which was outsourced to a university that then built this program that basically these people go through. Some of it's computer based, some of it's like sort of cognitive assessments, blah blah blah. They go through it, and it basically says they basically observe JTACs, observe the school, observe the course, and then said if people score this score on it, they have this percentage of passing it. So actually, the school implements that course, but it was written by some scientists and some people that understand that kind of thing, and then you get loaded onto the course. And the course in the UK is founded in what they call DTTT, which is a civilian oversighted university. So level three, so teaching at a degree level.
Yeah.
Their oversight is that. So everything they do has to be MOA compliant, but it also has to be DTTT compliant. So it's interesting that you're saying that your units are getting burdened more and more and more.
Yeah. I'll say this. I'm speaking from when I was working with the schoolhouses, and honestly, I'm speaking from when I was with Force Recon.
Yeah.
I was the senior JTAC evaluator for them, even though I was working for the comm shop again, right? Because they don't rate a senior fire as enlisted dude, which was a detriment at the point. But so I was working with the air officer. We were putting guys through school, and I'm getting phone calls from the instructors like, hey, this dude failed the initial assessment exam. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't sign his paperwork, and I'm the only evaluator in the unit. They're like, oh, well, this evaluator from another unit signed it. And I'm like, see, these are the drug deals. We call them drug deals, guys working through using the rules of the system as a checklist. And they're like, well, as long as I hit these rules on a piece of paper, they didn't say where the guy had to come from. And so guys are, that's the problem. Guys are too smart, and they learn how to navigate all the ropes, and they show up and they fail. So my experiences are probably a little tainted, and I would say, respectively, a little dated, because I've talked to some guys still reach out to me now for training stuff and tech stuff, because I'm still involved, but I've been out of the Marine Corps for 2 years now. So, it's like a laptop, right? After 6 months, you don't know it anymore. But I know that there's big institutionalized units, the bigger regiment size units, they're doing formal preparatory courses and sending guys through. But again, the problem I see is, okay, let's say I'm in unit X and I say, I'm going to host a prep course and the commander signs off on it. We agree on 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks, whatever it ends up being for the prep course. I get 10 students, 10 show up. Well, we only get two school seats. Okay. We only get two school seats for the next 3 months. So that prep course is going to expire, or even if it doesn't expire, the knowledge retained after not doing it for three more months is gone. So only two out of the 10, let's go optimistic. All 10 make it through the prep course, right? You don't flunk a guy in a prep course and send him home. You keep him for the whole 3 weeks. So you train him for 4 weeks. Well, that's 3 or 4 weeks. That guy who was never going to get a school seat to begin with has been not doing his actual job, and he's been trying to learn for a new job. So units are losing that capability. And so when I think of it, and my perspective is tainted by the Marine Corps, because Marine Corps has no fat, right? There's no extra guys in the unit. Everyone is deployable at any moment with any given purpose that he's supposed to be there for. It doesn't matter if you've got DUIs and you're in some assessment program for drunk driving, or if you're in domestic violence counseling, like, you're still deployable at any moment because your job is not expendable. Your position is not expendable. Maybe they leave you home and still deploy without you, but now they have to decide that's a vacant position, or we're going to fill that position in with someone from another unit. We're going to make some phone calls to get guys. I've seen that. So, for the Marine Corps to evolve, if I was king for a day, I would turn the academies, the schoolhouses, back into schoolhouses of learning and not schoolhouses of evaluation. Yeah. A test on day one should not send a guy home. A test on day one, in my opinion, a test on day one should set track for what your academic path is for that course.
Absolutely.
If a pilot comes through JTAC course and he gets 100% on the test on day one, maybe he only needs to be there for 3 weeks and get his stuff done and get out of the way. If a young, sergeant shows up and he bonks the entire exam, but he passed the little prerequisites, which are mainly computer-based training, if you alight on the prerequisites, well, now he has to do the full 4, 5, 6 weeks, whatever it is, and you train the guy.
Yeah.
So I think that if we can collectively go from a school of evaluating to a school of teaching, I mean, here's the deal. If you're called a school, you should be teaching, right? If instructors are running schools, there should be instruction before evaluation. But the truth is, instructors are just evaluated. And we've delineated an evaluation is an 18-month thing. Instructors do evaluations and grade sheets, right? But in Marine Corps JTAC school, you're getting grade sheets right away.
Interesting. Like,
there's no crawl, walk, run. And we always say, run at the slowest man's pace. You know what? The fires community, or the JTAC community specifically, I get it. We can't do that, because guess what? Warheads on foreheads. They're either good guy foreheads or bad guy foreheads. If they're good guy foreheads, we're all screwed. So I understand the risk. But again, you're looking at a guy who almost every school I've gone to with less than 7 days notice, and I'm not from that organic community, was able to take that no quit, never fail, approach, study, work hard. Okay, well, the prep course should be teaching those ethos. And if you can identify as a unit, he's an active learner, he's a committed learner, he's not going to fail, he can adapt and overcome the stress. If you send all of those guys, I guarantee they pass every time.
Yeah, I think we'll come on to it in a second, but obviously your CO turns around to you and says, hey, you want to do this JTAC course? And you're like, yeah, fuck yeah, let's do it. Obviously, you roll up in the course, and I'm sure you have some memories of the course that you can probably share with us anyway. But going that quickly from JFO to JTAC, in my head, I think that's was probably a good thing, right?
So it worked out to my advantage because
it's all fresh.
And I went to the same schoolhouse. I went to East Coast JFO, and then I went to East Coast JTAC, or TAC-T, as we called it in Marine Corps. And it worked out to my advantage because these instructors had just seen.
Right.
Their first impression was, why are you here? The rules say you're not allowed to be here. You actually have to do more time after JFO school before you come here.
Okay.
I was like, don't ask me. I'm not the guy who does the paperwork. They asked me if I wanted to come. I said, yes. You talk to the guys who do the paperwork, but a bunch of people signed it and I showed up.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there was some There were some that's not fair grudges.
Classic.
From some of the instructors. But again, I use that as energy. If I see you looking at me with a crooked eye, I go, listen, I don't have nothing against you. You don't have nothing against me, actually. What you have something against is someone who signed waivers and sent me here. Because there's always a waiver for anything, right?
Oh, yeah. So
they sent me here, and I'm going to show you that I deserve to be here. And I look at it as always like a challenge. And I tell you what, when I left JTAC course, every single instructor, we had each other's cell phone numbers, and they were, I ran into them multiple times throughout my career. I still run into my senior, the senior enlisted guy to this day because of my civilian capacity and his civilian capacity, we happened to cross paths. So
yeah.
That was pretty cool. And I still keep in touch with every instructor I had from JFO and JTAC course. So, you know, if I left a good impression on my instructors, I left a good impression on everyone I've ever directly worked with. The only people who I've had negative interactions with are the people I have not had face-to-face interactions with.
It's funny, isn't it? I think our community, like you've said it a couple of times, it's like you start, like you talk about your career before JTAC and then like almost after like with JFO and onwards, you instantly start building a black book. You instantly start starting a Rolodex or, you know, whatever it is, you know, a contacts list in your phone or whatever. But like there is pilots, you know, that I know their children and I know their wives and like I go to their barbecues and, you know, I've had instructors that taught me on my basic course on this podcast, and I would have every instructor who taught me on my basic course I would have on here because, like, you know, it's an interesting community where it's like, hey man, give us your number. Do you know what I mean? Because you genuinely want to take care of each other. And it's an interesting thing when one of my questions that I put to a lot of people is, as an outsider looking in, what's the biggest myth about this community? And I don't want to answer that question. What do you think, as an outsider looking in, is the biggest myth about our community?
Biggest myth? Well, you know, again, my opinion's tainted, right? So the biggest myth, I think, about our community is that JTACs kill people. And we don't. JTACs buy bombs. Ground Force Commanders buy bodies.
Yeah.
And some JTACs, that's a hard pill to swallow for them. And they're in the community. I think we get our ego, you know, so the myth to me, and I learned this, I was a private first class. My first deployment, again, a lot of freaking, call them haters, whatever you want to call them, call them jealous, call them just guys who don't understand or guys who just, you know, refuse to believe other people's words. My first deployment, I was on I'm a Marine private first class, and I'm on an Army Special Forces team with Anglico. And we're running around, our whole Anglico team with these guys, and we're doing things we probably shouldn't be doing. And I'm a private first class, and we're another night, another event of chaos. And I have a captain hand me a radio saying, hey, Teddy, because we all knew each other at this point. And it's, you know, it's a great feeling. I'm a private first class, and I got a captain calling me Teddy. Some blonde dude who speaks Spanish. Go figure. And he's like, here, take this radio. We have a C-130 gunship. I need anything moving in the river killed. And I'm like, don't you have to be a JTAC? And it was like, no, C-130 gunship, you don't. And so I was like, cool. And so I'm talking with the gunship, and the gunship goes nuts. And so there's all, and so I was like kind of soft introed to air support. I don't even call it CAS. And this was, you know, 04, 05. So being JTAC was still an unspoken thing for enlisted guys to begin with. So it was like, hey, IR signatures in the river. Okay, cool. Got it. You know, what do you see? So it was, the myth is, you know, JTAC was a tough course. I give it that. And growing as an instructor and an evaluator, those upgrades, if you want to call them upgrades, I don't call them upgrades, I just call them progression. But those are difficult achievements to attain. And you're proud of them when you get them, you know, to the point where some services will give out a new patch for guys upgrading. But the myth is that JTACs are unilaterally killing people. And no one says unilaterally, but everyone looks at a JTAC and goes, that guy's killed a lot of people. I mean, I've met a bunch of SMU guys who are like, dude, I want to be a JTAC. You guys get more kills than all of us. Like, no, we don't. We get zero kills. Snipers get a record of their kills. JTACs, yeah, there's a BDA somewhere. But a lot of it has a battle space owner, call signs, ground force commander call signs. Yeah, my call sign's in there for seeing clear hot. So is the pilot's. But saying a JTAC kills someone is just as equivalent as saying a pilot kills someone for a close air support or area detection. When the truth is, no, there's someone with a lot more liability on their collar than either of us who said, yeah, I'm willing to let these people die. And if it ends up being bad, I'm willing to take out.
Yeah. I mean, I'd agree with that. I'd agree with the statement in the fact that that's how it's written, and I'd agree with the statement in the fact is that that's probably the way I feel about it as well. But I'd also like to like add to anyone that thinks they're going to come into this community and thinks that they're going to like land all the shit that they do at someone else's feet that. That's just not the case, because the amount of times that I've done something and everybody that was involved suddenly fucking vanished when there was an investigation.
Yes.
And then suddenly when the investigation turned out that everything that I did was correct, they all reappeared.
I'm so glad you said that, because the next thought in my head when you brought up that
it's a fucking lonely world. That's all I'd like to say.
Well, you know, it's funny. I became a jump master before I became a JTAC, and I got very familiar with investigations. So it was every investigation I've ever had as a JTAC, I was well prepared. That's why I tell you, like I told you earlier, people offer me these handouts and these opportunities, and I say no to almost all of them. And I go this way and I go that way and I follow my path. That I'm like Jack Sparrow making it up as I go.
I want that compass.
Yeah. And that's what it was. I was following the compass of what I wanted the most. And I've achieved some of those things along the way, but I like, you know, why did you become a jump master? I don't know, because I thought it was cool to be able to open a door on an airplane and then jump out of the fucking airplane. Like, I wanted to be the guy who was in charge of that. And then I found out all the science behind it. Like I told you, I'm a closet nerd. So learning about terminal velocities and wind stream vector counts and all of the forward throw of a jumper at different airspeeds with different altitudes and different airplanes, loved it. I got to nerd out on my math brain and I studied more than a jump master is expected to, but because it intrigued me and it made me smarter all around. So I loved it. And what I realized is, you know, we lost a guy. We actually had a guy die on a static run jump once. And it was jumper error. There was some institutional unit program things that we shouldn't have done. I didn't support or advocate against the prepping training that was going on for some of these jump operations. But there were some things that, you know, maybe I just didn't agree with and I kept it in my head. But then the investigation came out and I was a jump master with another dude and we had a kid die. And we looked at all the variables that could contribute to that. We saw what we could do differently. No one held us at fault because of what he did was blatantly incorrect and not in accordance with what everyone else had testified towards. And I realized real quick that, okay, you know what a jump master is for? Someone to blame. And then I was like, wait. And I became a JTAC later on. I'm like, you know, with today's technology, you don't really need a JTAC. I still believe you need one, but I thought there's probably three quarters of airstrikes. Let's say non-soft, because there's some soft activities that are difficult to do unilaterally. But with today's airborne technologies, there's very few instances where you need a JTAC. A JTAC is, in my opinion, whether you're on the ground or in a talk, you're the person handing out the driver's license at the driver's license office, right? The pilot is the driver. Okay, the pilot of the bomb is the driver driving the car. It's the guy who you give the license to. The pedestrians around you are civilians. And if you crash into somebody, that happens to become a target. inadvertently, or cops could be the enemy. However you want to look at that metaphor, it's kind of flexible, but the truth is you're just handing a driver's license for someone to drop a bomb every time. Because what's going to happen is when that bomb drops, they're going to go, and let's say the situation goes bad, they're going to go, where'd you get your license? And they're going to investigate the person who gave the license. They're going to investigate the JTAC first, every time. They pull the tapes, they call the JTACs first. They don't even ground the pilots. The pilots are flying sorties the next day. But your call sign, I've seen it, not to me, but I've seen dudes' call signs turned off in theater for 72 hours pending an investigation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's normal. Yeah.
But the pilot's still flying.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah.
Which, by the way, well, I'm not going to name drop, but can I nation drop? is that, we got a free pass. It's my opinion.
Yeah.
I will say this. I love their energy, but I've never seen more bad GBU-12 drops than the Belgians. I just got to say that.
Interesting. So,
if this hopefully someone looks at 100 years and goes, well, the Belgians turned it around. I hope so. But they've been the subject of many of my investigations. So
obviously, qualifying JTAC school, coming off the back of that, how long does it take you to spin up for a deployment after you
get
through those two things?
So when I did it, the Marine Corps, well, and I think it's still the same way now. Again, my information can be a couple years outdated, but when I did JTAC course, you leave with an eval.
Okay.
You leave with an eval in the Marine Corps. I will say this, after working with SOCOM for the last 6 years, the Marine Corps does things their own way, and I feel like the Marine Corps removes the J from JTAC. I really do. And it's not because of the way the Marine Corps executes it, it's because of the way the Marine Corps records everything administratively for the training. So when you leave JTAC course in the Marine Corps, we used to have what's called the combat phase. And that's what you needed to do to deploy. But if your unit was deploying very quickly and you didn't have time, you can have an 06 sign a one pager saying, he didn't have time, but I still want him to go forth and do cleared hot things. So it's kind of like a made up thing. So I got sent to a task force once. This is later in my career. I got sent to a task force once, and they were already established. They already had an evaluator. I'm not going to say anybody's name. I won't even say the units, because it's probably a soft spot in some people's eyes still. And I respect these guys. They're all good guys, but they just didn't know any better. They were all what I call baby JTACs. The Marine Corps evolved the combat phase, combat ready phase. They ended up calling it, the 2100 phase, let's call it. I think that's 2100 syllabus, 2100 phase. You had to complete this 2100 syllabus in order to deploy. But if you didn't complete it, you can have an 06, sign a piece of paper saying he missed, codes 1, 5, 7, 11, 19, 24, and I still authorize him to drop because he didn't have the time. And we had to deploy. We were deploying one way or the other. So when these guys are not meeting the prerequisites for the combat stuff, which most of the joint community, whether it's Army, Air Force, Navy, and I'm sure I know where you are. MQT is what's next, right? So if guys are not doing their MQT, which the Marine Corps called 2100, if they're not doing that, there's very few exceptions to the policy. And the joint community said, we're going to make the exception go up to the general officer level. Whereas the Marine Corps is like, yeah, we're smaller. We're going to make it the 06. And so I think there was just too many easy passes, a shortcut. So I get sent to this task force. I show up. The JTAC evaluator, I guess he didn't get along with the boss, 06 or the 05, colonel and lieutenant colonel. He didn't get along with them. So he was not designated as an evaluator while they were deployed. So that already tells you things are shaky. So I was kind of nervous walking into this thing because they sent me out there and this guy's out there. And it's a task force, kinetic thing, counter ISIS or destroy ISIS, right? And then all the JTACs were all officers, no enlisted. They're all pilots, no ground officers. And they all graduated yesterday from the course. And they did all of their codes they were supposed to do, but a lot of these codes, let's say there's 25, 13 of them are supposed to be live. These are made up numbers, not even close probably. And 12 of them are supposed to be simulated or can be simulated. You can still do them live. Well, these guys did all of them in the sim because they just didn't have the time to get the live aircraft. And then they sent them down range. And these guys, you know, they're doing stuff and they're doing it wrong. They've had their call signs turned off, each one of them, at least once or twice. So I show up and I'm like, all right, well, what's the higher headquarters procedure? What's our rules of engagement? Because you guys don't have the ROEs posted up. You guys don't have tactical directives stapled to your desks. You don't have all these cheat cards. This was a strike cell, if you haven't picked that up by now. You guys don't have all these cheat cards available to you. You got 12 fucking screens in front of you. You've got too much ass in the game. You need to have a cheat card for all this stuff because no one's going to – you're not going to all memorize this. I'm like, the only thing you guys are doing right is your air stack diagram. I applauded them on that. But I'm like, because you guys are pilots. You're used to that. And oh, well, I'll take it a step further, and I'm not talking trash about a community. They were all rotary wing pilots. No fixed wing. So there's no diversity in this community.
It's a strange situation, isn't it? It's strange that
really, unit. It really is weird, but these task forces, they get put together so last minute. You know? Dude, you've got like four cups going on. What do you got going on? I'm jealous.
Don't worry about it. Don't overthink it, man. So what's your first deployment?
My first deployment, I was a private first class on an Anglico team. We sent out Anglico reinforced teams. So a normal Anglico team, five guys, we sent 9 to 10 for each team. That's kind of how it shook out. We had 9. And I was attached to an ODA. The numbers don't exist anymore because they changed their organization, but it was ODA 774. So it was ODA 774, an Anglico firepower control team, and an El Salvadorian special forces team. And that was great because every mission, every mission brief, you know, cordon knock, brief was in Spanish because ground force commander was the ODA captain, the blonde dude I was telling you about.
Yeah.
Imagine picturing like a 26-year-old blonde dude speak only Spanish with a blonde mustache, like pale-faced American from Arkansas, and he's only talking Spanish because the ODA team was 13 guys, the Anglico team was 9 guys, El Salvadorian special forces team was 25 guys. So you got 50 dudes in these mission briefs, predominantly Spanish speakers.
Yeah.
Well, I had to learn Spanish really fucking fast. I didn't know it before. So that was my first deployment. And we were just, these guys were authorized to collect their own intel and find their own targets. And every so often we get nominated a target. I think there was probably two particular incidents where we did some tier one SMU shit. And that was pretty cool. My exposure to that. I didn't know how it mapped out. What the difference was between tier one soft and not till later in my career. I just thought I was out there running and gunning with these guys, and they taught us everything we needed to know, and it was great. I still keep in touch with some of those guys today.
What was your first JTAC tour?
So my first JTAC tour was I was an Anglico team leader, and I was a sergeant, and I was a radio operator, not a radio chief. That pissed everyone off. Everyone. So an Anglico team leader is supposed to be a captain, pilot, or artillery officer. If you were lucky, you were a staff sergeant, E6, 0861, experienced JTAC. Well, I was an E5 sergeant, radio operator, JTAC. Fresh out of those two schools within the same 12 months that I told you about.
Yeah.
But I finished my combat ready phase, so I was more qualified than 75% of the fuckers there. And then the commanding officer of the unit, Lieutenant Colonel, he held a competition. He's like, I'm going to have a competition with all my JTACs. Not my JTACs. He didn't actually care about the JTACs. All my team leaders. And me and another sergeant, we were both team leaders. And we competed in this competition, and it was company-wide. So company-wide means you had, well, technically we only had 8 doctrinal teams, right? 2, 4, yeah, 8 doctrinal teams. But I think there was like 13 teams competing. So there were some other guys who wanted to be teams and organized an ad hoc team to try to compete. And he said, oh, the top eight are going to go. So me and my buddy, the other sergeant, he was also a radio guy who became a JTAC. So we're two anomalies already getting hate from all the captains. And all the enlisted guys hated us because we were not of an enlisted billet. We were of an officer billet. So they're like, fuck you, get out of here. Go hang out with the officers. And we're like, all right, fine. We'll go sit in the officer's trailer. We sat in the officer's trailer in the back of the compound. And we just got bad mouth right to our faces. And we're like, you know what? We'll see what happens when everyone's putting a radio and rifle in each other's hands. And we lived by our, as long as you're not wrong and you don't quit, right? Go back to those ethos I was telling you about that I have personally. It works out. So we did the exam. It was really a 2-week thing, but then there was two particular evaluated events. And the one evaluated event was, hey, an infantry guy shows up. He tells you, hey, you're my team for fires, combined arms. We're going to take the hill. And that's all it was. It was running from bottom to top, less than 1,000 meters, taking a hill. But there was remote controlled machine guns, artillery simulators going off everywhere. Complete fucking chaos, right? Call it the Medal of Honor run, right? It was like that kind of chaos they wanted to induce upon you. And they literally had instructors and evaluators for every guy on your team walking with an index card and a clipboard, like writing down notes. And it was very well done, very well done. It was more academia like than schools. And your job was to receive the ground commander's mission. Then you had to build a terrain model with your team, brief your fire support plan in accordance with the maneuver plan. So good doctrinal stuff. Then you had to execute it. You also got evaluated. You got deducted points for how far you deviated from your actual brief to execution. Because if you just did a poor job of planning, you briefed a shitty plan and you deviate, let's say you did great on the execution, but your plan was shit. Well, then the truth is you didn't do a good job of analyzing the risks and the mission and the necessities. It was a very well thought out, put together exam. I've tried to replicate it many times in my career, yet to do so. Maybe one day. Now, with that being said, myself and the other dude, we both scored second and third in the entire company out of 13 teams. I want to say it was 13 teams. The only guy who beat us was not an organic guy to the unit. He was a Navy guy who came in from outside, but not a Marine. So all the Marine captains scored fourth place and worse. Well, they picked the top eight teams. Here we go. Then they had to drop the numbers, typical manpower shit. They had to drop the numbers from 8 to 6, I think, or something like that. And two more captains got the boot. And we stayed. And these guys were so fucking pissed.
Yeah.
So then I deployed, and I ended up getting some weird counter-narcotics, counter-lethal aid task force working with the DEA and this made-up hodgepodge dudes. We had snipers. We had intel guys. We had dog handlers. We had bomb guys. We had engineers, EOD. We had it all. And then my four-man team, and we all came together. We worked directly with the DEA, directly with battle space owners, which was Marine leadership. And then we got a bunch of fucking Afghans at the time to get attached to us. I think they were called the NIU, the Narcotics Interdiction Unit. And our job was to find as many people trafficking opium, heroin, or weapons and take them out. Whether it was compounds or moving vehicles, take them out. And, you know, kudos to our intel guys, because this task force was replicated 3 or 4 times throughout the AO. I know the Aussies had a piece. And we had a piece. And then there was another, like, some dudes down in Dwyer. Remember Dwyer? It's like a Marine base way down south. They had a piece, but it was so quiet in the AO that they ended up, like, making fun of their own mission. And they called it my brother was a corpsman. He went down there. They called it Operation Ruined Family Vacation, because they would stop all these vehicles that they thought were trafficking drugs. And it'd be like a white sedan going 80 miles an hour through the fucking desert, looking like a Grand Theft Auto video game car. And the helos would fucking shoot out the road in front of them. They'd stop them, this dramatic event, and they pull them all out. And there's like 13 people in there. And they're like, oh, we're going to bury our grandfather. He's in the trunk. and they found like a rigor mortis body in the trunk. Like their story was legit, and they're just like ruining people's lives, not actually catching bad guys. So I think that's a funny anecdote. But that was a great mission for me, because we had a really good intel section. We only found credible targets. We very, very rarely had a dry hole. I mean, it was billions of dollars we ended up getting credit for denying in lethal aid. Some great airstrikes happened. Whether they were in accordance or not, not for me to decide. All I know is for 4 months, I did it for 4 months out of my deployment, I never filed a MISREP. Not once. I got back to Bastion Leatherneck, and I get a phone call from the air officer, the big air officer of the theater. He's like, "Are you?" My call sign was Chosen 69. That was a good call sign. I've always got the 69 number. I was kind of hoping this was episode 69, but hey. And so he goes, "Princess," he calls me up, "Princess, this is you, right?" I'm like, "Yeah." He goes, "Yeah, I saw you just updated your phone number in the Sipper." I was like, "Yeah, what's up?" He goes, "I need your fucking MISREPs for every airstrike." I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Every MISREP." I'm like, at this point, I was so kind of like used to living out of tents and helicopters. I was like, "What's a MISREP, dude?" He's like, "It's an Excel. I'll send it to you." He sends it to me. I have to do like 83 of these fucking things in like the next 4 days. Hated my life. So then I became a good admin JTAC too. Because if you're doing MISREPs on the fly, you just do them to do them. But if you can do 83 of them, you just find a good way to distribute the information across all of them.
Yeah.
Just like submitting JTARs.
Oh my God. So what year was that?
That was 2012. 2012, first JTAC deployment.
So come back off that deployment, obviously a lot of knowledge. Do they decide they're going to use you for training, or do they cycle you back around?
No, straight to training. Like you said, straight to training. I also went back to Hurst Master's course, right? Helicopter rope suspension training. So I went to Hurst Master's course and rappel instructor, fast rope instructor. And then I did extracurricular, became a cast master, all these other things. And so I really, you know, I've been lucky enough to get, like I said, throughout my career, I say no to opportunity A, which seems great, like a golden nugget. Like I could have not gone out of that deployment in 2012 and done some other stuff. And I would have gone through a selection and assessment and blah, blah. But I said no to that deployment. And what did I do? I worked directly with the DEA, did a bunch of counter-narcotic shit, and was briefing dudes who I had no business briefing. And I'm a young, lowly sergeant who's not even a fires guy by trade, right? Communicator. Because, you know, everyone looks at you because your baseball card. It says 06 radio guy. That's what your baseball card says. So I got to live this great experience that not many people did and do some great shit. And we had a great team, great camaraderie. So I went straight to training, which fast-tracked me to an instructor upgrade pretty quickly. Then I did another deployment in 2014 and then another one in 2016. And then went to Force Recon and helped them try to stand up a program. Didn't work out so well. They wanted to do things more off the books than on the books. Typical Force Recon thing. Still got great friends from the unit, but I had to hang it up and move on to some other adventures. I finally said yes to the shiny object they were dangling in front of me. And so that's where I'm at now, is working on this new special thing.
When before we get away from your JTAC and career too far, what would be your favorite platform? I mean, I know that obviously you talked about the gunship and stuff in early on in your career and stuff like that, and I know that Mark jumped all over that the other day, but yeah, what's your favorite?
My favorite platform, it's a close tie. And people are going to laugh at me, but you know, it's because of the amount of it's the amount of cleared hots I got off of them. How easy it was to get the cleared hots is kind of how I looked at it. Well, I'll give you top three. Can I do that? Can I give you a top three?
Sure, show, man.
All right. So it's a tie for first place. So 1 and 2 for the Aussie F-18s and the Air Force F-22s. The F-22s don't have a pod, so they'll do whatever the fuck you want. they'll drop on anything because they can't see it.
I suppose it's one way of looking at it.
Dude, plausible deniability all day.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
they don't pack the biggest punches, but they pack a lot of small punches in terms of casts. And
yeah,
it was very easy for me to get them to drop. And they're very no bullshit. They're very like, okay, cool, this is what you want. We're gonna do it. So yeah, I like that.
I think the Air Force particularly is very good at doing CAS as it was written, almost, if you know what I mean. The JTAC says this. Do this.
I'm gonna give you a top three. So the number one and two are those guys. Why Aussie F-18s don't get the number one straight away? It's not a platform problem. It's a can I say this? If I have to ask that question, I won't say it. So I gotta find a different way to say it. It's a national authorities problem. If I'm running across a border and you have to turn your jet around, then you're not, I can't give you top one. I can't give you the trophy. But the Aussie F-18s, they're like JTACs with a pilot's license. I loved working with those dudes. You could probably categorize some drones up there, but the problem with drones is it's depending on what shift you get, which I don't like that. So I'm not even going to put them in the top three because I've had some really shit drone crews and really good drone crews. Now, moving on, number three, I got to give a plug to the – I've only seen this a couple of times, and I don't ever think it's intentional. I don't know how they do this. If I get a section of F-18s off the boat – U.S. F-18s off the boat, right? So they flew along. They flew a whole crew day to get there for the most part. And they've been hanging out waiting, usually in X-CAS or G, you know, X-CAS, not in G-CAS, but X-CAS, waiting, burning holes in the sky, waiting to get called. So when they do get called, they're ready for business. But I've always had the best results with them when leader-2, didn't matter who, one was Navy, one was Marines. And maybe because I'm a Marine, I always have that conversation with them and you kind of pick it out throughout the talkies. But and the reason they're in my top three is my very last airstrike overseas was by a mixed Navy Marine US F-18 off the boat section. Somehow the video, not my fault, I made it on LiveLeak. I'll send you the link later. It's pretty fun because their call sign was also Freedom. So I was like, this is pretty awesome. My last airstrike ever. I kind of knew it was because I shifted my priorities to going back to be a family guy. So I was like, last airstrike ever. I knew I'm ripped TOA for my new JTACs for tomorrow. Last airstrike of the day. I'm showing off to these guys what we've been doing for months. And the call sign's Freedom. And we're dropping a fucking 1,000 pounder. I'm like, I couldn't ask for a better last airstrike. So they got a warm place in my heart for that. And they're always easy to work with.
With everything that's rounding up for you sort of in your mind, if you could go back and speak to either a younger version of yourself or a guy who's, you know, plugging into the pipeline at the start, what sort of three skills would you say, hey, you know, double down on these three skills. These are the things that are going to make you successful in your career. I get it that you're going to be taught things a lot. You know, we've already talked about the fact that, you know, learning needs to take place. So I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about three genuine skills that you can take from beginning to end that are important to remember.
So I don't know if I can categorize them in like a one or two word answer for those three skills. But I would say is the top one, I would say, and I've always believed this, but I didn't do it, was, you know, don't burn any bridges. I've definitely burnt some bridges because it was more important for me to be right than it was for me to be fair. So don't burn any bridges. You know, like everyone, at the end of the day, we're all trying to get to the same thing. Are there some guys who are cocksuckers out for their own career? There are. And I treated them as such. And there are guys who are just hating on you for your success. And I treated them as such. But that necessarily wasn't like the right response. So don't burn any bridges. Always trying to find a path to making us all get along would probably be my number one like skill. Like, hey, dude, Remember that thing that Gunny taught you when you taught that SATCOM class back in the day when you first checked in Anglica? Like, just because you're right, you're not wrong thing. Like, he's right, but he's wrong. So, like, finding a healthy balance in that message. There is a level of importance to delivering, and it is bigger than sales, right? So I'm kind of like reneging on my own sentence in the beginning, but I believe if I could give myself advice, I would go back and do that, because I didn't necessarily make enemies, but dude, I had a phone call today. I had a buddy call me from fucking Marsoc today. He's like, dude, I met this guy. He's pretty high up in the fires thing. And he's like, he's not fond of you. And I had to remind him that you're like my blood brother. And I'm like, that's funny, because all my interactions with him were super positive. And I just realized that, like, you know, when you walk out of the room, this is probably bullet number two, don't take anything for granted. When you walk out of the room, people will speak the truth. They're not going to speak the truth in front of you. Whether you're good, bad, indifferent, people are going to tell the truth when you're not in the room. And so I pride myself in always being able to be as honest as I am for my perception, right? Like, I am not unaware. I do a lot of Department of Justice work in my civilian life. I'm not unaware. Even a judge knows there's three truths: yours, his, and the truth. So, you know, speak your truth and don't be bashful about it. So that would probably be bullet number two. Bullet number three, and I have not done as good a job early in my career as I've done in the second half of my career, is you didn't get here on your own. I worked my ass off. I weathered the storms. I sucked fumes out of, you know, exhaust pipes, for lack of a better phrase. Like, I had to break through a lot of glass ceilings to get to my level of, call it success, but I feel like I'm still climbing that ladder, but just not in the Marine Corps uniform anymore. I'm doing it in a different arena. But you didn't get here by your own efforts. People did have to advocate for me. People did have to network for me. People did have to say, that dude's worth it. And don't ever take that for granted. And so always, this is something that I cannot express enough of, is gratuity, humility. I say thank you more than I say hello nowadays. I just have to. It's in my core, because, you know, dude, I look at myself 20 years ago and I was the kid at the bus stop, right? You look at where we started this conversation. I was the fucking kid at the bus stop. Now I'm over here doing things that shape different policy decisions, and I'm shaping life-saving technologies. I'm doing shit so beyond what I ever thought I would be doing. JTAC was one small stone on the path to get here. And thank you is really what I've got to take away from everything. You got to be gratuitous for everything.
Yeah. I really enjoy, I mean, obviously we're at episode 66 and you'd rather it was 69. I could just save this one and roll it out at 69.
No, we're gonna be honest. Remember honesty.
I'll roll it out. But it's funny how 66 podcasts later, everyone's still saying, "Own your fucking ego. It's a double-edged sword." You know, yeah. you can be too overbearing, and you can be too humble. You know, they're saying, maintain a growth mindset. You can always learn. You can always change. You can always be better. And everyone's always saying, we're stronger together. There's no way that you can ever achieve everything that you want to achieve on your own. And it's funny that 66 podcasts later, it's like ego, growth mindset, stronger together. And it's just like, it just comes around and everyone just says it in a different way. And I want to be like 200 podcasts in and be like, there it is again.
Dude, you don't even need to wait that long. This is what you need to do. You need to call a company right now and who's already doing machine learning and say, here, download all my podcasts and tell me what the trend is in learning. And when those three things come out, because I'm confident they will, listen to you, when I'm confident they will come out, you can go to the joint staff, right? Because the U.S. joint staff hosts the JTAC MOA, right? Mm. You know, the joint staff and go, look, here's what every single one of your JTACs have said.
Yeah.
And that's the fact. Like, I mean, you've created a learning tank without knowing it. Now you got to find someone willing to pay that ridiculous amount of money to download all the games.
Maybe you and I know it's not that for that. It's for a bit of a laugh. And let's say, so like taking it down that line, a little bit more lighthearted. If I was going to make...
that's my civilian business mind always going up. Now that I'm like, I'm out of the Marine Corps and I'm still connected and associated and read on, I'm doing some things more civilian-like.
Yeah.
You know what it's like.
Yeah, I hear you, man. And so like a little bit more lighthearted. Obviously, I'm going to take you out of the world you're in now and put you back as a JTAC. I put you on a desert island, and obviously, I'll give you a radio like I do with everybody else and a decent set of ancils that don't screw you. But what are the three other items that you take with you to the desert island?
All right, so let's review. What do I have with me?
You've got a radio.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Any radio? Because like, what radio matters? Because remember, I'm a combo guy, so you're stroking my first chord.
Yeah, any radio you want, and any set of ancils you want, and they're all fully functional, which is like the fucking thing that never happens. But what are the other three items that you take with you?
Like, when you say item, it has to be like a tangible piece of inanimate property.
Yeah, no, like wishing for no more wishes. It's not like, oh, I'm gonna, like, I had one guy, he turned around, he's like, oh, I'm gonna take my fucking go bag. And I was like, well, what's in your go bag? And then they listed fucking 40 items. I'm like, no.
What about like if I take three other people?
Three other people? Okay, fine, but they're not allowed to carry anything.
Yeah.
Everyone's naked.
I'm on an island, but the island's not just sand and water, right? It's a normal island. There's natural features and all that, right? You see, you're talking to... I guarantee you get this every time. I don't remember...
Yeah, wishing, everyone wishes for more wishes. Like I'm a fucking genie over here.
No, so... Hey, you rub the lamp, dude. No, if I had to take three things, it'd be one inanimate object and two people.
Okay.
Okay. The first person I would take, and you know, they get made fun of, they get a lot of memes, but I would take one of the Air Force Special Operations Command SEER instructors. Right? I'll take that guy. He knows how to make fire out of clouds. So I'm bringing him.
Okay.
So he's going to make sure no one dies.
Okay.
The next guy I'm taking is a Force Recon, United States Marine Corps Force Recon diver.
Okay.
There's no one more proud of how good he swims other than him. Okay. And we're on an island, which means there's water 360 degrees around.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm just taking a strong command. The next thing I will take, because I already got a radio, good stuff, right? So I'm taking a fucking knife. I got to have a knife.
Okay.
So cool. I got a guy who's going to make fire out of clouds somehow. I got a guy who's going to swim around and catch fish and do other shit, make boats and do everything else under the sun. Probably more that I don't want him to do, but he's a Marine Force Recon swimmer. So he's going to do what I want him to do 25% of the time, 75% of the time. He's going to do what he thinks is cool. And that's okay because I'm still going to get what I want. And I'm going to command these dudes. So we're going to survive because we got fire. We got fish, and I got a knife just in case either one of these two motherfuckers start acting up.
Okay, well, God forbid we have to do fucking CAS at any point, but anyway.
We're on an island, bro. There's no CAS. They're going to shell us before they fucking even come ashore.
I think we lost the premise of the question somewhere along the line, but I still enjoyed the answer. I still enjoyed the answer all the fucking same.
Yeah, see? I know where the premise was. I definitely... completely made a 90 degree turn, like a 90 degree left turn, wrong direction on the highway. Yeah.
No, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Teddy, I know that we've probably recorded not enough of a podcast here to even do it justice, but I do appreciate you taking the time. If you had sort of like one closing message across our entire community, and I would kind of broaden that out to, you know, not just ground guys, but air guys, and also, you know, veterans as well as those serving, what would your kind of closing message be?
Ooh, you slipped me up. I had a really good lead in thought. You slipped me up when you said veterans, because that's a new animal. Can I give you two then? Can I give you one for guys on the forefront, guys with veterans? Can I do that?
Yeah, man. Sure.
So, you know, veterans have a different perspective. So if you're still out there getting it or trying to get it or aspiring to get it, you know, my advice is never forget the customer. Never forget the customer. I had this saying with my all my Marines, soldiers, and sailors when I worked different environments was reverse customer service. As a JTAC, you're a cashier, or at the DMV. Go back to any analogy I've kind of gone into. Like, you have customers and you have bosses. Reverse customer service. Give your customers more than they expect. Give your boss more than they expect. Like, reverse customer service was important. So like, if a dude was like, hey, you know, we're looking for this intent, take it a step further and confirm and refine commander's intent. Go, if I do these bombs, because this is all that's available, a lot of JTACs will go, hey, commander's intent, destroy, neutralize, suppress. Like, come on. We all know there's differences in destroy, neutralize, suppress. Like, so go the extra step. And the only way to go the extra step is to study harder. So I call it, you know your customer. Is your customer the ground commander? In certain instances, it is. The ground commander may have given you carte blanche. You got a good relationship. I've had great relationship with ground commanders where, like, dude, just drop the bombs, kill the bad guys, and brief me afterwards. And I know you know what I'm talking about when I say that. But then your customer's not the ground commander anymore. Your customer's higher, because when you start running freedom, when you start running and gunning like a JTAC who thinks he's unilateral, but you do have that conversation with the ground commander ahead of time, well, your real boss at that, your real customer at that time is your boss, is higher headquarters, and so you got to appease them. So know your customer and make sure your customer's happy, and you'll never have a problem. That's how I see it. You're a JTAC. Just answer the radios, man. Now, that does not apply to veterans, because veterans are dudes who are just full of complaints. Veterans are customers. So if I had a shout out to veterans, can I do a quick anecdote story? I know we're running out of time, but
we're never running out of time, man. We're in the digital age.
A buddy of mine, we were in a Hilo incident together. Very close friend. I mean, our daughters are the same age, like by 6 months, and they play together for years now, since 2013. And he broke his back in his Hilo incident. We were both in rappelling at night, blah blah blah, on a thing. And he recovered well. He got screwed over a little bit, did the admin thing. They finally took care of him, got retired medically, blah, blah, blah. It's not enough to survive. So he's still trying to find other work and all this other stuff. He recently came down with an illness, and it wasn't COVID. And he was in the hospital, and he was on a ventilator. And he was also on dialysis. So lung failure, liver failure. The underlying cause was pancreas, and they're like, oh man, and they were telling his parents, and you know, we're so close. His parents and I talk, and, his parents don't live close and I live close. And they were like, he's not going to make it. We got to start arranging things. And that was heartbreaking. And I realized, his mom and dad weren't here. So no one was. He's got a daughter, but he's divorced. You know, every Marine, we say you got to get that token divorce. And it struck a chord with me, like, for veteran advocacy. I've always been a big fan of veteran advocacy. And it's not like, oh, USA specific, all of them, because I've got some good friends from Australia. Really do. Worked a lot with those guys. No names, but worked a lot with those guys. We still chat today. And it's that whole, you know, I got your six mindset. Like, you got to take that seriously. Take that shit seriously. So, like, I go visit this dude right now. He's in the hospital. He's fucking 20 minutes away. I talked to him right before I talked to you. I was on the phone with him. I'm like, hey, bro, you know, Thanksgiving's coming up in America when we stole the land from the pilgrims. But, yeah, hey, what are you doing for that day? Because we got to break bread. And I see this guy all the time. I do his fucking laundry. I go in there. I give him a fucking haircut. So as far as veterans go, the biggest thing I could tell each other, whether this community, you can be the fucking admin, the supply community, like, discard everything you ever knew about somebody while they were in service. Because all that matters is we all took the same oath, and the oath is almost identical across nations. So don't even like select, oh, Americans only. Like, no, if you find out a dude from any military service is like at the local hospital near you and he's fucking unconscious, find out if his family's there. And if his family's not there, then tell the hospital you're his brother or you're his sister. Because that's what I do. I walk in, I say, I'm his brother. And they let me in. Because of COVID, you can't get in unless you're family. So I go, I'm his fucking brother. And they're like, oh, you have different last names. I'm like, I'm adopted. And they go, cool, come on in. Like, do what it takes to take care of each other. Because I've seen too many funerals posts on like Facebook or LinkedIn or any social media. I've seen too many posts with like, hey, a veteran from World War II dies, no family, guest wanted. Like, what kind of shit is that? Like, veterans, we should be taking care of each other. And so I'm a real big fan of veteran advocacy. My brother, Navy Corpsman, he wants to start a whole thing about it. We'll figure something out down the road. But, you know, that's why I say there's a different answer when you included veterans.
Yeah, man.
I hate to say the cliche, like, you got to live and breathe the I got your six mentality. But you do, because guess what? I know 10 other fucking dudes who know this guy who live within 10 miles. And I live 40 miles away. And I'm driving extra time to go see him. I'm not complaining. What I'm saying is the dudes who live closer, why are they not going to see him? It's, you know, oh, it's inconvenient for their life. Well, you know, I'm willing to sacrifice a couple of hours of pay to take care of some dudes and women. I've been serving with a lot of women, so sorry.
No, and I get that. And I think I'm terrible for it. And I think I've been poor for it at time, but like whenever I say guys or I say team or whatever, I'm not saying male genitalia at that fucking point. I'm more than happy that I am including everybody in it. Plenty of fucking.
I don't want to go to the death radical. I will say this. I'm working with a woman Marine and I'm trying to inspire her. We have some mentorship conversations, nothing weird. I got a family, so nothing weird, but I'm trying to inspire her to become one of the first, I think the first female enlisted JTAC.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. You know, I try to mentor people. I have people from every unit I've ever been in still calling me today. And to me, that's more of a sign of success than any award I've ever gotten.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. I think, it chimes with the strong, we are all stronger together. You know, we are one community and in a larger sense, we need to take care of each other. And I think obviously the JTAC podcast is here and everyone's welcome to come and sit and chat. And obviously we've had Abram drivers, we've had Apache drivers, F-15s and, you know, and we've had snipers and recce guys and, you know, and just because it's about who we've interacted with and whose lives we've touched and stuff like that.
Dude, I got a buddy. He's an AFSOC special tactics officer.
Mm.
And he was a Marine Corps Anglico JTAC. And before that, he was a Navy corpsman. This guy wrote a paper on why Anglico should have snipers.
Yeah.
And it was fundamentally, it made sense because I was like, you know what? What if Anglico is doing surveillance and reconnaissance in an observation post, like their normal duties are, which you could extend that beyond Anglico, go any fire support team. It could be a JTAC and his ROMAD. It could be any pair of dudes, chicks, whatever, do an observation on enemy and they find something that is not a nominal close air support target. What do they do? Yeah. Well, if they have a sniper rifle, it makes it real fucking easy to decide.
Yeah. I mean, I guess anyone that knows me will hear this come out of my mouth a lot, but obviously I'll be like, well, why did you not put a fucking javelin in it? Do you know what I mean? Like people will have an argument like, oh, I'm going to drop on it. I'm like, well, why did you not put a javelin in it? And I know that sounds like an oversimplified
version
of what you're saying, but I'm like, why didn't you go left flanking? Why did you keep?
We're gonna cross some wires here, but I remember distinctly our 529 brothers asking for Marines to shoot the javelin because maybe someone's rules of engagement weren't met and someone's were.
Yeah, I can believe it.
I'll tell you this, the JTAC community, if I had a sustain, keep threading the needle. Keep finding every loophole there is to do your job, because that is 99% of the award write-ups you read, the measurements of success are because a JTAC found a way to get to the solution that the rules were preventing him from getting to.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You've summed it up nicely, and I don't really have much more to add other than, you know, your closing bit about veterans is super important. I would say to everyone, don't be the guy who fucking posts on Facebook, "Hey, I'm here for anyone that reaches out." Don't be that guy. I'm not saying that's not a good person. I'm just saying be the guy who reaches out, that picks up the phone and dials a number himself, or goes to the hospital and figures it out themselves. And tell you, man, you know.
Are you live?
No, I'm not live.
Okay, I'm getting more texts right now from like random dudes I served with. So that's weird.
That's kind of cool. The galaxy or the solar, whatever it is reaching out to us. But, you know, if anyone is listening to this now and they want to put their story on record, I'm telling you now, there's guys who are listening to this on their commute to work, and it's the one thing in their fucking week that they look forward to is hearing your story. So don't lock your story into your mind and fucking die with it. Put it on tape.
And Neil, this story goes way beyond JTAC now. I want to
ridiculous.
Know that. Like, I took my daughters, I got four daughters. I took them all to a firefighter location, firefighter station here in South Florida. And the reason I took them there was the first all-woman firefighting shift. Like, all the trucks were ran by women. No one's ever done that in America, anyways, or in Florida, or in that county, or whatever. I don't know what the municipality. It was a big fucking deal. Let's put it that way. Just all women. And I'm like, it's 2020. That can't be a big deal. But I have only daughters. I don't have any sons. So I took the girls there, and it was funny because now we follow each other on social media, and they were hitting me up, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, hey, I'm going on this podcast. They're like, oh, I can't wait to listen. And so, like, you know, this self-growth, community empowerment, those are the most important things. If you identify with seven communities, empower all seven communities. It doesn't have to be veteran on veteran, you know? And I think that conversations like yours, I mean, dude, this is exactly what it's about. I mean, there's no other forum where you and I would have sat down and had this Q&A. This is it.
No, man. And I feel truly privileged to be the guy getting to do it. So thank you.
No, thank you, brother. Dude, and thanks for the boxes in the background, because I was like stressing. I'm like, I don't have a background. I downloaded a Zoom image with the office background. Like, I was like, I'm so screwed. This guy's got a professional podcast. I'm screwed.
Nah. Just a fucking headset and a load of boxes, man.
Dude, appreciate the flexibility of the time. Like, you know, there's a lot of guys out there who are like, oh, if you don't make my time hack, you're done. By the way, this is the first podcast. I've been invited to a lot. This is the first podcast I said yes to. And again, it's because of your layout and how you've done it. Genuine.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Teddy.
So cheers. I don't have a red.
Thank you. And I appreciate you taking the time to listen. All our podcasts sit on the 9 Foot Night Killer Collective, Soul Feed, Forge Not Made, and the JTAP podcast. Take some time, maybe listen to one of the other podcast series that you're not listening to, and give us your feedback. All these things only happen because of the 9 Foot Night Killer community, and we really appreciate them. Thank you, everybody, for listening.